Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Just as it's been 50 years since the March on Selma and many landmark moments in the history of the Black struggle for civil rights, it was half a century ago that the groundbreaking Black arts movement was pioneered by such great activist artists as Amiri Baraka, Maya Angelou, and my guest, Sonia Sanchez. Sonia Sanchez has written more than 15 books of poetry and stories and was named the first Poet Laureate of the City of Philadelphia in 2011. Born in Birmingham, Alabama, she eventually moved to Harlem, New York, where she became active in the arts and in civil rights activism. She was a member of New York's Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, and also deeply influenced by Malcolm X. She taught and lived in San Francisco before eventually making her way to Philadelphia, where she still lives. Her 1969 book of poetry called Homecoming catapulted her into the national stage, and her latest book, Morning Haiku, was published in 2010. She's written and published plays, won major awards, including the National Book Critics Circle Award and the American Book Award. In fall of 2014, she co-edited an anthology called SOS, Calling All Black People, Black Arts Movement Reader. Ms. Sanchez was in Los Angeles for a speaking event at Cal State LA yesterday, and the Uprising crew had the opportunity to meet her in her hotel room, where I had a wide-ranging conversation with the legendary poet. Oh, welcome to the program, Ms. Sonia Sanchez.
Thank you so very much, my dear sister. It's good being here. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a seminal year. 2015 is the 50th anniversary of so many important historical events in terms of the civil rights movement, with the Selma March around 50 years ago, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and you were around when that happened. And I'm wondering if you can reflect on those tumultuous years and these anniversaries that are being celebrated and commemorated this year.
Oh, my dear sister, you know, it is, I'm in September 9th, I turned 80, and you know, and I thought, gee, I've become my father, I've become Gwendolyn Brooks and all these other people who had made 80, Elizabeth Catlett, all these great people I knew. But the great thing is that if you live long enough, you'll hit 80 and perhaps 90 even. And of course, part of your life has been experiencing so many of these things that were important events in this country, those things that made for change. You know, someone said to me recently in an interview from overseas, I mean, what does it mean? Some people say, Professor Sanchez, there is no change at all. And I said, well, if you live during those years, you realize there's a lot of change. It might not be all the change that you want. And one of the interviews I just had with Katie Couric was the whole idea of To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, the significance of a book that was written at the time that it was written about the 1930s, but it's a book written in 1960, and what that really meant, and about a man who actually defied an entire town in order to defend a black man. Well, my dear sister, who was accused of raping a white woman, but if you understand the civil rights movement, you also go back, remember the Scottsboro Boys, that a lot of that was happening at that particular time in Alabama, where I was born. And you understand at some point that one individual decided to fight a system. The problem is that he didn't win, that the young man, those young Scottsboro boys, and in the book, To Kill a Mockingbird, the man was hanged. And so one of the things that is significant about the civil rights movement and the movement of people in the South and also in the North in a slightly different fashion is that, you know, in order to effect change, you do need a group action. You do need a group response to an injustice and to things that are not working well. So you can have the singular action of a person who is indeed very much involved with being a just person. But in order to really affect change forever or for a long time, you need the mass movement, which also happened at some particular point. And we saw all the mass movements, you know, happening. I was in New York CORE, and we thought we were the baddest thing going on the planet Earth, because we were the most radical, you know. You named it. We went and picketed, whatever. And I like to tell the story. My dad told the story with a crew from Germany once. The question was asked, was your daughter always so progressive and activist? And my dad said, and I saw it and I fell out laughing, he said, no, She was so quiet. All she did was read, and she stayed in her room. He said she never gave me any problems. It's true. I was this perfect child along the way. But what happened is that events of the world happened, and one of the things that happened is that being in New York Corps, I was at the office one morning, and someone called and said that the unions were going to build an extension on Harlem Hospital at 135th Street. And we had been trying to open up the electrical union, right, and the plumbers union to Black and Puerto Ricans, and they refused to even consider it. And so we found out it was that was going to happen. So we came up to Harlem and we threw this massive picket line around Harlem Hospital. Well, my dad told the story that he heard all the noise. We shall not be moved. We were singing, and he focused his binoculars and saw his daughter downstairs, down there in the streets. We had blocked off the streets. No cars could pass at all. And he was so upset. But also he turned the binoculars up the street and he saw policemen coming on horseback. And we didn't see them. Our backs were turned. We did not see them coming at all. And he didn't. He dropped his binoculars on his terrace and went running to the elevator. It didn't come fast enough, and he went running down the steps. But as luck would have it, but you know, my dear sister, there's no such thing as luck. It's just the work that we do, you know, to effect change, you know, how we decide to effect change, and that is not through luck. The first Black police captain was being driven to work, and he came around the corner. He couldn't get to the precinct, so he jumps out the car. He says, "What do you people want?" And we said, "We want to open up the unions to Black and Puerto Ricans." And he says, "Well, don't do it in the street. Go downtown." So they went inside and got the union leaders, and we went downtown, actually, and all day until 2 o'clock in the morning, we negotiated back and forth. And finally, the union person said, okay, give us some names. And we were so young, and we didn't expect to win. None of us had any names. All the names were back in the office. But I stopped and said, "I can give you one name now." And I gave the name of my brother, who was an electrical wizard, you know, who took care of everything in the house. And so by the time I got home about 3:30, the phone was ringing, and I knew it was my dad. In those days, the phone would ring forever and ever and ever and ever and ever, you know, until you picked it up, right? And so I got a cup of coffee, I lit a cigarette, and then I said, "Yeah, Dad." You know, he said, Sonia, why don't you just get married and have some babies and move to Long Island or New Rochelle?" And I was rude to my dad. I won't tell you what I said, but then I said, Dad, tell Wilson, my brother, your son, to report to the union because he will now join the union." And he said a very strange thing. He said, "Sonia, you mean there's a job?" I said, "What do you think we're in the streets doing?" "Yes, it's a job." And that was the opening up of the unions in a place called New York City at the time that it should have been opened up. And you see, you reflect on that, and someone says to you, "There's no change." You say, "You must be out of your head," because there was change. Change at great risk for many people, change at deaths also too, change with people, students who gave up their careers in universities to go into the movement, bright people, but they knew that part was very important.
Now, this was also the time that was the beginning of a very much related movement, and that's the Black Arts Movement that you've been a pioneer in alongside such great figures as Amiri Baraka and the late, great Maya Angelou. Yes. So this is also something that people are sort of celebrating. Now, how important has art been, and was art even at that time, to the movement?
Well, my dear sister, before that's what that book talks about. The book is, we just did an anthology on the Black arts at the University of Mass Press, Professor John Bracey and Professor John Smethurst and myself. And what we reflect on in it, about a 20-page intro, is simply that public art was not in play in America until Black arts came along. And then you had the mural arts happening. You had the government giving fellowships and monies, you know, to various organizations so people could come and do their individual work. You had maybe someone going along and doing simple things, but this was major because at some point we said, you can do this public art art, it can be revolutionary. You can do murals that, of course, we all learn from Mexico, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the great mural is there, that will be so important for a people. You can do a poem that can be political and great at the same time. And of course, this is what we did. And this book is dedicated to Baraka, because it's called SOS, Calling on Black People. You know, it's not, and it's indicative of what was going on at that particular time. But Baraka turned around and said, hold it, there are problems here in this country. And art can affect change. Art can be a place that people can learn from, and you can write a poem that will change people. And what, and it's dedicated also to people like Brother Martin and Brother Malcolm. We contend in the introduction, my dear sister, that the people who influenced BAM, the Black Arts Movement, were two important people, John Coltrane, you know, and Malcolm, you know, and John Coltrane, who said, I can go out of this Western construct, you know, and bring you music that will go someplace else and be completely important, completely revolutionary, you know. And Malcolm said, hey, you know, if you live in a community, you should be very much involved with, you know, constructing that community in the way that you want it to be constructed. So you have, but by the time we get to BAM, they're both dead. And who's the person who's then going to lead a movement like this is Baraka, you know. And you get all the great writers. You get, you know, of course, Baraka. You get Larry Neal. You get Hakeem Adebuti, you know. You get Askir Toure. You get Maya, Sister Maya. You get Sister Toni Morrison's in there with her bluest eye. You get all of these people coming up. You get June Jordan, Audre Lorde. I mean, all these amazing people, you know, who are coming up, constructing poetry that says it can be about change and it can be great and it can be beautiful. And you get all the great art. You get the plays, Ed Bullins, you know, with his great plays also too. You get the plays that all of a sudden will get on Broadway because of that push and move of the Black Arts BAM. And then you get Black Studies coming out of that,
right,
also too. And I came to a place called San Francisco to begin something called Black Studies. And I remember telling my dad, I'm going to California. My dad said, oh, no, you're not. I mean, New York is the only place to live. And, you know, I was so naive about California, my dear sister, that I was saying to people, you want a heavy coat because I'm going to California. It's warm and hot out there. And someone said in a very droll fashion, you don't know San Francisco, do you, Sonia? It gets very damp out there. And thank God I kept my heavy coat. Yeah.
Earlier you were mentioning that your father thought of you as a quiet person who only read books. How did poetry help you find your voice, and how has poetry helped young people? You know, you're obviously in, mm-hmm. in the academic world, mm-hmm. as well, and mm-hmm. you're teaching English. How can poetry be a tool for finding one's voice?
Oh, my dear sister, what we found out about poetry, I call poetry the definition, because there are many definitions of poetry. In an essay I wrote many years ago, I said poetry is subconscious conversation. It is much the work of those who listen, you know, and those also, you know, who write it. One of my teachers at NYU when I was in grad school was a woman by the name of Louise Bogan, who was a classical poet, you know, who taught us form. And we were quite upset by the idea that she would teach form, because, you know, we were going to be these poets, you know, who didn't need to deal with form. But I'm so glad she taught us form, because she made me truly understand that all free verse has some core, some basis of form. Mm-hmm. But what we did there with poetry is that we took from other countries and other people. We took from also the beats who were right before us and around the same time. You know, Ginsberg, a great beat poet, Paul Blackburn, a man I loved very much at that particular time, you know, and the men and women who moves thusly, and also many of the poets who also were down in the village, I'm blanking on his name, here in California. We were talking about him last night. forgive me. The yellow back, broken down. Isn't that wild?
Ishmael Reed.
Ish. Forgive me, Ish. Ishmael Reed, you can edit that part out probably. Ish, and all these people who came out of the village also too. What you understood is that you could say a poem And you could affect change. The people in the audience, it was almost like church on some level. People in the audience would stand up and be so invigorated to go out and to do something, to change their lives. That was the beauty. And, you know, I was saying last night at dinner, you know, with some of the people that I'm involved with here at this particular time, that the great thing is that we learn from people like Coltrane and Malcolm. Malcolm would involve you with a conversation. He would bring you up to great heights, but he was wise enough to bring you down before you went out. Mm-hmm. And so we learn from him the cadence of Malcolm's speaking, the cadence and the use of words, and also the use of humor. If you study the black poetry, the use of humor is all over it. And so you made people laugh at the same time that maybe they were crying or maybe they were angry, but you made balance. There was a balance to the poetry, but it was poetry that said simply, you know, I can tell you about change in the world, in this country. I can tell you what it means to be a human being. Because the question we were tempted to asking, to answer at that time was, what does it mean to be human? Mm. If you have been discriminated against, if you come out of slavery, right? If you come, you know, if you live in a place where nobody respects you, if you're in a place where the police come in to your neighborhood and pick up the young boys and beat them up, you know, at the station, what does it mean to be human? If you go into a classroom and the teacher comes in and hollers and says, "I don't know why I'm going to teach you anything," looking at the girls, because all you're going to do is get pregnant. Mm. Or she would look at the boys and said, "I don't know why I want to teach you, because you're just going to end up in jail." And I remember, you know, coming from a place called Birmingham, Alabama, where the teachers loved you and constantly taught you. I remember thinking, not me, sucker. You know, right? That's not going to happen to me. But just think of all of the people that it did happen to, because there were people who did not respect them, you know. And, you know, and you begin to think of Carlos Fuentes, you know, who said, you know, we only treat people like that when we cannot imagine ourselves also being those people. So what we try to do as poets is that we try to imagine ourselves being someone, whatever, which meant then when once you did that, you had the greatest respect for them.
Now, this year is also the 30th anniversary. We started talking about anniversaries. It was the 30th anniversary of the bombing of the Move House in Philadelphia. Oh, yes. And you were there, where you were living at the time, but I understand right at the moment it happened, you happened to be out of town.
The Sunday I left, I was heading, I finished my classes, I got my grades in, and I was heading off for this huge conference in Georgia. It was not in Atlanta. You know, you took a plane to Atlanta, then you took a small plane to some place in Oshkosh, Georgia. I'm being facetious now. And then someone picked you up and drove you to this little town, which I found out later was a town that had been heavily segregated in the South. And by the time I will reach my hotel room, the good thing about Georgia is that they had CNN at that time. And I turned it on and boom, I am watching destruction in Philadelphia. And of course, I called my children right away. And I said, "Tomorrow, when you go to school, there will be a discussion. And we have to talk about what we do as moral people." And my children said, you know, I talked to them about the first time a bomb was dropped on an American city. It was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the 1920s. And majority of people killed, it was dropped on a black neighborhood, and they were black folks. And so I said, you must have this information. Because I said, if you take this position, you will be attacked in a verbal sense. And so they said, mommy, okay, you know, whatever. And so I would then go the next morning. I am opening the conference, my dear sister, and at 9 o'clock in the morning, I'm watching 1,000 people looking at me, and I know they're thinking about one thing. They too have been up watching what was going on in Move, right? And I give this speech, and they were so appreciative. They stood up and clap, sat down, Q&A. First question, Professor Sanchez, what kind of people live in Philadelphia who would drop a bomb on a civilian population? And I said, my dear brother, I can say two things. I said, I am not here to defend the mayor you know, the police chief, the fire chief, you know, and all those other people who were involved with this. I said, but my dear brother, what I do understand that the people of Philadelphia are also completely alarmed and startled by the dropping of a bomb on a civilian population. I said, it was not a moral act at all. This is not what you do. And then I explained to them, and they didn't even know about Tulsa. I explained to them about Tulsa, Oklahoma, and people said, really? Did that really happen? And I said, yes, and I explained to them, you know, the consequences of that and what happened. So one of the men stood up and said, well, I am so glad, Professor Sanchez, you said that, because if you had said something else, I was going to take all my students out of this auditorium, because he said, thank you so very much. But you had to take a moral position on the idea that you would allow a bomb dropped on the civilian population for the second time in American history. That night, I talked to my children. That afternoon, I talked to my children. And, you know, both of them had tears. You could hear them kind of get filled up. And they were attacked because, I don't mean physically, mm-hmm. but people were saying, well, you know, they have this funny hair, these dreads, and they were, in quotes, dirty, and they upset the neighborhood.
This is the MOVE organization.
Yeah. And this is what children were saying to my children in class when they defended, when they said, you cannot do this to human beings at all. But they were saying, well, it was okay to do it because, and one of my sons, Magoo, said, Mom, I said, yeah, you can disagree with people, but you don't kill them. The whole point, he said, of democratic country is that you leave room for discussion, but above all, you don't drop a bomb on the civilian population at all. And so I was so proud of them that I was going to a place called, when I got back home, Oslo, Norway, for a big conference with Jimmy Baldwin and the great Mexican poet Octavio Paz, right? And I said to them, because they had taken a position, your children should be rewarded, you know, for taking moral positions. I said, I'm going to take you with me to Oslo, Norway. And what was interesting about that, I opened the conference, my dear sister, and then while I was being interviewed for a documentary, they were interviewing my children. And they asked them, what do you think about your mother? And they also took the same position. The next day in the newspapers, right, they had, you know, and it had to be translated for me, Professor Sanchez's children take the same position she takes. But as they interviewed me, there was a cameraman who was quite distressed. You know, he was moving back and forth. You know how you note it, but you still kind of out of the side of your ear. The first question, it was ostensibly an interview about my poetry, you know, mm-hmm. and about the conference and what I thought about the conference. It was this documentary they were doing about the conference. The first question was the same question they had posed to me in Georgia. Mm-hmm. Professor Sanchez, what kind of people, you know, and I said, you know, good people. Good people live in Philadelphia, but I'm not talking about, you know, the officials at all. I'm not here defending them. It was completely an unjust act, an incorrect act, you know, period, I said. And the cameraman stopped and said, I'm so glad that you said that, because I was going to leave if you had said something else. I mean, you didn't realize the impact until you travel around the country. For 1 year, being on the road like this, I defended Philadelphia, you know, against, I mean, an attack. I mean, every place you went, they said, Philadelphia, you're from Philadelphia. Oh, Philadelphia. Oh, your city dropped the bomb. I said, no, we didn't drop the bomb. The officials dropped the bomb. And some officials let a whole city block burn. But I said, so I defended us as moral people there, you know, who did not do that at all. It was a very interesting year when that happened. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you can also reflect at this time on someone who has been very vocal about the MOVE organization, also a Philadelphia resident currently behind bars, and that is, of course, Mumia Abu-Jamal, the great journalist mm-hmm. and someone who many people consider a political prisoner. And mm-hmm. People are very worried that Mumia is dying right now and is being sort of allowed to die through medical neglect. And how important has his voice been? He's, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, my dear sister, you know, when there was a trial, Mumia, in the city of Philadelphia, three people testified for him. Father Paul Washington, a state senator, and I'm blanking on his name also too, and myself. I was amazed because people, he was a great young journalist, very political, and I was surprised that people, when I was on, I was being, there, I was attacked by the prosecutor as a person who was the lover of people who kill police. And that attack brought for another trial, by the way. The lawyers took that, text, right? And that's why they got another trial, because it was completely off the rack, incorrect. I turned to the judge and said simply, because I watched Perry Mason. And I said, shouldn't his lawyer object to this, And I looked at the jury, because it very evidently was incorrect. The judge said nothing. As a consequence, they were able to overturn that and do another one. I testified for Brother Mumia as a character witness, sort of Father Paul Washington, and Richardson was the state assembly's name. And we were character witness saying simply what he did. We didn't know what had happened there. We knew there were some contradictions about what happened, and we knew that he needed to have a fair trial, which evidently he was not going to get there. I have visited him also too, and have written to him. I am always amazed by the brilliance of this young man. And of course, I was with Angela. Sister Angela was up, we were together up in UMass at Amherst having dinner. And my phone kept, I had it turned off, but it kept, how it buzzes, right. And finally I said, let me take this. It was my son who said, Mom, let me tell you what's happening. And I leaned over here while someone was speaking, and I said, Angela, this is what is happening to Mumia, because she's been a supporter also of Mumia, along with the great Ozzie Davis, and then after Ozzie died, Sister Ruby Davis also too, Ruby D. Davis. So we made that announcement there. So I think you're right. When you're in prison like that, people will allow you to die. You're not going to get the best physician. You're not going to get the best care. And you're going to get people who are completely antagonistic towards you at that particular point. But I'm just hoping that he can pull through it. I'm hoping that people are humane enough to give him the proper care at some point, because it is supposed to be a justice system. You're supposed to get into here, and you are supposed to be treated well. But you and I know that does not happen in this place called America. Yeah. Which has one of the worst histories of taking care and not taking care of their prisoners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Many people see the mass incarceration today, particularly that is disproportionately impacting African Americans, as just an extension and continuation of slavery. And at the same time, on the streets today, we have a burgeoning new movement that has been in the news more so than usual, mm-hmm. and that's the Black Lives Matter movement. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you can reflect on those issues, given that those things that didn't get fixed after the civil rights movement, that remain, mm-hmm. The mantle is being taken up, it seems, by young folks.
Right. Well, we're always so happy that young folk look up at some point and say simply, whoops, this is a problem. And you say, yes, it's still a problem. It has been a problem for a very long time. That's why this... I was autographing the book I was talking about, and young people came up with a book like this saying, oh, whoa, we didn't know that this happened here in America. I mean, when they read the poetry and they read the short stories, right, and they read the plays, they said, well, we didn't realize that this happened during your time also, too. They tend to think this is all new. That there's no history or history involved. And what the book shows is that each generation has got to respond to the racism, what I call the indecency of a country, the non-morality of a country, the non-morality of its leaders. And so they are seeing how we responded right? And now they realize that they must respond. So yes, you have people, organizations coming up, Black Lives Matter. You see people who have still been involved with welfare in New York City. You see people all around the country now are gathering together saying, we must respond to this in a very important way, because young people are being killed. And that's why you go back and you read some of the poetry in that book. You see Audre Lorde responding to, like, a grandmother in the Bronx. The police will burst into her house and kill her. You know, Eleanor Bumpers, right? Or a young Black male, you know, would get killed in the streets. Well, it's the repetition. And young people, what the young people were saying to me with the books, clutched to their hearts, I didn't know that there were young people who'd been killed before. And you didn't want to say, yes, unhappy enough, we've seen it before, and we responded in the same way. And I'm saying simply, that response must be there, but there's another part of that response also too, you know, and that is a demand of going into the Congress, going into the Senate, going in and demanding of the Congress people, you know, and the senators, you know, that something else happens here. It is what I call neo-slavery. It is the new slavery, you know. It is that in a place called Pennsylvania, you can shut down schools and build two new prisons, you know. So it means that if you shut down the schools, if you make the schools overcrowded, the kids won't go to school, you know, we'll get them in prison, you know, we'll get them from almost free labor, whatever. So I will build what they call the great, great prisons, but they will not build great, great schools. So part of this is, yes, demonstrating, but part is also redirecting attention to what is going on, you know, in education, you know, what is going on in this system, you know, that imprisons young people. What is going on when I was in a place called Alabama, leaving Alabama one Sunday, that you had a judge who was affiliated with his brother-in-law who ran a prison, and the judge was then sending the young men into the prison so therefore they could do the work. So this kind of immoral acts going on in a place called America, but also the idea what Martin Luther King said many years ago, that we need to have people who can get a guaranteed wage. And if you have guaranteed wage at some particular point, then it puts less pressure on families. You know, families stay together. People can then be very responsible to their children. And so we need to push issues with the federal government and state governments also, too. So it is demonstration, but also people sitting down in a wise fashion, beginning to reconstruct, you know, what it means really to have a humane government, a humane city and state dealing with their people.
Sonia Sanchez is a legendary poet, one of the founders of the Black Arts Movement, speaking to me in her hotel room last night when she was visiting Southern California. This is Uprising. We'll be right back.